Ask the marshal to go ahead and call the case when you are ready.
Calling case A24-0059, Rzeszkowski versus Barrero.
Right, good morning.
Good morning.
So each counsel, you'll have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. You can take your time getting situated. The podium will adjust up and down, and you'll see the lights on the podium with the time, and your time will be running there. Please make sure you identify yourself and your client at each portion of your argument when you stand up. And appellant, counsel for appellant, when you're ready, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, I'm Robert Dew of the DeWitt Law Firm. I'm appearing today for the appellant in this matter, Pavel Rzeszkowski. This is our second trip to the court for relief. In the first appeal, appellant prevailed on two issues, which were remanded to the district court. First, this court held that the public policy exception to the doctrine of comity requires postnuptial agreements to be procedurally and substantively fair, and remanded for the district court to conduct a substantive fairness review of the postnuptial agreement as of the date of its proposed enforcement, or to use the court's language, whether enforcement of the postnuptial agreement would be unconscionable, not whether it was unconscionable when it was signed 13 years ago. Second, this court accepted the findings of the district court that appellant did not have the means to pay his attorney's fees, and that respondent did have the means to contribute to his attorney's fees, and remanded for the district court to determine the amount of appellant's fees that was the result of the good faith assertion of his rights. And this court noted that some of the claimed attorney fees related to assertions of rights that were made in good faith.
On the question of unconscionability, a few questions. I have some sort of big picture questions that I'm struggling with. One, biggest picture, what is the standard of review for the determination of as to whether this is a case of unconscionability when it comes to the enforcement of the antenuptial agreement?
Well, the district court did not follow the remand instructions. The district court conducted no review of the substantive fairness of the postnuptial agreement as of the time of its proposed enforcement.
Well, the district
court, I think it's an error of law. That's the standard of review. I think that...
Well, the district court did say, I mean, the express holding... reference enforceability and fairness in enforceability. So our standard of review is, you say, then just as a matter of law,
the district court said that whether an agreement is unconscionable is a question of law. That's in the order. I think Mr. DeWalt in his brief says it's a question of law. But I think the fundamental error is that there was no review of what had happened during the marriage.
Well, before we get to that, a couple other big picture questions. So there's this, I was struggling as I was trying to think through this case about, it feels like there's two points in the analysis where this idea of unconscionability might come in. One was our court remanding it to the district court on the notion that this is essentially a foreign judgment, and foreign judgments are enforceable as matters of comity, unless those judgments are, doing so would be unconscionable. And then you have this other layer, it seems to me, where you've got this common law idea of fairness and enforceability and unconscionability coming into the analysis there. I'm just curious whether the single term unconscionable applies the same way at both levels. Is it just one legal question that we've got and it's the same legal question?
I believe it's the same question.
Okay.
I think the...
So I guess then the other big, I think you're probably right. I couldn't figure out how to structure it differently. What is the meaning of unconscionable?
Well, the meaning of unconscionable is that it is egregiously unfair to one party, that it leaves one party in a situation, a post-divorce economic situation that's unjustly disproportionate, that it doesn't take into account all of the events that occurred during the marriage that would render enforcement unconscionable.
I thought so, too. I looked at some of the case law. It was hard. As you think about the term unconscionable, it's like you've got, in the middle, you've got fairness. What's fair? And then you've got perhaps an unfair outcome, but that's not necessarily unconscionable. It's got to be, as you put it, egregious or in the extreme, sort of shocks the conscience kind of unfairness. And so I'm looking at this case, and I'm not sure that I agree, and you can disabuse me of my hesitation of agreeing with your view that the district court didn't actually address this, the question of unconscionability at the time of enforcement. If you look at the district court's analysis, part of the analysis included the communication that occurred during the marriage where your client, according to the district court, this is a finding, your client wrote, and I'm going to quote here what your client wrote to the attorneys when the parties were considering a move to the United States. We want to protect the assets that are in Carolina's name, both the ones currently held by Carolina and those she will acquire in the future from Powell's creditors. Therefore, we need to find a way to make valid these legal agreements. In other words, so it doesn't appear to me necessarily so that the district court, although it did keep referring to the actual execution of the agreement, the district court seems to have considered, after the execution of the agreement, the parties have been married for now several years, they're going to consider a move to the United States, and your client is wanting to make sure that the antenuptial agreement is enforceable in order to protect wife's assets that she has and future assets. So in light of that, I'm wondering why that's not a consideration of what's going on in the marriage as to the enforceability, because the district court does go on and talk about the it not being unconscionable to the enforcement after the court said that. And I'm trying to get a sense of why it would be unfair, let alone unconscionable, under the circumstances where before the marriage, you've got husband not working, wife making a lot of money, wife concerned about that, wanting to make sure it's part of the agreement, husband agreeing that it should be part of the agreement. Then the marriage continues. He's still not working. She's the one who's making most of the money. He gets a job, but then quits or leaves the job after 6 months, even though he's making something like $260,000 a year in the job, and then continues to be unemployed. And the district court says he's voluntarily underemployed. Under those circumstances, I'm trying to figure out what would be unfair for him to walk away with essentially what he had at the beginning of the marriage, in the middle of the marriage, basically what he's earned on his own, not what she's earned. Help me to understand why that's not fair.
Well, Your Honor, that's a very long rhetorical question.
It is a rhetorical question, but that's, I figure I'm going to play my cards and let you know. I don't know where my colleagues are on this, but that's the part that's troubling me. So if you want
well,
to
communications
me,
you refer
I want you to know
to,
what you have to overcome.
The communications you refer to were not long after the marriage. It was before they moved to the United States. I think you have to look at what happened after they moved to
the United
States.
But it was
a couple
of years after the marriage began.
True, but we're talking about a 10-year marriage. I think you have to look at what happened after they moved to the United States. So they moved from state to state, from New York City, where my client did have some networking connections, to Georgia, so that she could accept a job with Bramples. Then they moved from Georgia to Minnesota so that she could accept a job with Cargill. That obviously interfered with his ability to develop a career at any one of those locations. Parties
but
had,
why is that a concern if the district court expressly found your client voluntarily unemployed, like his choice to be unemployed, I mean, it might be a different circumstance if it were he's trying to look for work. I mean, he's been, the district court says it's been 2 years. You've had two job interviews. The district court didn't take seriously that he was even interested in getting a job. Under that circumstance, why does it matter, the differences that you made in the employment of the wife to the husband?
Well, why it matters, Your Honor, is that the end result is that she walks away with assets of $1.2 million. And
no, I get that, but the question is, why is that unfair? And certainly, why is it, or more to the legal issue, why is that shockingly unfair, egregiously unfair, under the circumstances here where they bargained for that at the beginning, and throughout the marriage he continued, even after the marriage he continued to remain voluntarily unemployed?
Well, if you look at the history, he had been unemployed for 14 years. He had one temporary job through Cali Temporary Services. That's the one you were referring to. It was a 9-month job. They didn't ask him to come back, okay? So, but he didn't get spousal maintenance. I mean, that's all relevant to spousal maintenance, these findings. But the idea that he moved from state to state, she earned $1.9 million from 2014 through 2021. She earned over $350,000 during the year prior to trial. There was evidence she intentionally titled assets in her own name. They had a joint account with almost $800,000 in it. Before the divorce, she moved that into her name alone. But to go back to my original point, there is not much, and your point maybe to some comments, there's really not much in the district court's findings that address unconscionability at the time of the proposed enforcement. There's findings as to my client's mental health, his legal capacity, the lack of duress, his understanding of the agreement, et cetera. But we never claimed that this agreement basically says the rights of the parties will be as if no marriage took place. We never claimed that that was unconscionable at the time they signed it. We never did. We had some procedural problems, but we never claimed that. So the question is it substantively fair at the time of its proposed enforcement? We don't see how it could be. And I would ask the court, bear with me.
Why, though?
We're all supposed
to. Why is it unfair? I guess that's what I'm struck with, when a question of fairness, when you've got.
They had twins. He participated in caring for the twins.
So did she.
Well, at least he says more than half, at least half. So that was an expenditure of time. The McKee Johnson court said that the birth of a child can be an important factor. Other courts say you look at the disparity. This is not a 75-25 split. This is he got nothing. And she got $1.2 million. And I have never seen, there's three detailed orders. None of them say what she got. None of them say what he got. It's almost as if the district court was embarrassed to say that. Yeah, she can have $1.2 million. He gets nothing. No finding about that. I think we're all supposed to be sensitive to gender bias. One has to question, in this case, whether the outcome would have been the same. The appellant had been the wife, having followed her husband from state to state in furtherance of his career that enables him to earn $350,000 a year, having born and cared for twins, and now leaving the marriage, no spousal maintenance, no assets, no award of attorney's
fees. Is there evidence in the record that the disparity between their relative net worth and their assets was exacerbated over the course of the marriage? Or, in other words, they started the marriage where she had more assets than he did. They ended the marriage in the same situation. But is there evidence in the record that, say we agree with you that a district court erred by not focusing on unconscionability at the time of enforcement, but that disparity grew to such a degree so as to be unconscionable? Because I understand Judge Ross's point to be they kind of started and ended in the same place.
Well, not really. I think at the time they got married, she had about $192,000, if I'm not mistaken, in assets in her name at that point. He had, like,
including the apartment?
Yes, that included everything. That was in that. They signed a prenup, which really is not at issue here, but that was in the prenup.
Right. So, and she also had a substantial high-earning job at the same time that he didn't.
Well, she didn't keep it very long because she was with Pfizer. She worked in New York. When she got terminated by Pfizer, she took the job at Brambles. He moved with her from New York to Georgia. So
I don't want to distract you from finishing the answer, Judge Eade's question. I'm
well,
sorry.
Yeah, the answer is obviously the disparity did grow over the years, and it grew in part because she intentionally titled everything in her name. And that was pretty clear when you had a joint account.
Why is that inconsistent with what he asked for? We want to protect the assets under her name, both the ones she currently held and those she will acquire in the future. It seems like when I read that, I mean, that's not a her statement. That's a him statement. And it's after the marriage, after the agreement. We want her to keep what she's got and the stuff she's going to get. So we're keeping everything separate. So your challenge that she intentionally kept things separate seems to be consistent with what he anticipated would occur under the agreement.
Well, and I think that the reason that he said that is he had some student loans in his name, and she was applying to be a U.S. resident, and they wanted it to be clear to everyone that these were her assets, and she wasn't responsible for his loans, okay? But again, that was shortly after the marriage. It's before the birth of children. It's before the move around the United States in furtherance of her career. It's before she amassed $1.2 million in assets in her name, and nothing was in his name, nothing. So I think the focus should have been at the time of the divorce, not, you know, 2 years after they signed the agreement.
Counsel, your time has expired.
Okay, thank you.
You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent, when you're ready, you'll have 15 minutes.
Please, court. My name is Jack DeWalt. I represent respondent Ms. Carolina Uribe Barrero. Good morning, Judge Ross, Judge Eade, presiding Judge Smith. On behalf of Ms. Uribe Barrero, I'm asking the court today to find that Judge Thomas did not abuse her discretion and to uphold her decisions in all respects. Her conclusions were that the party's Colombian agreement was not unconscionable, and that appellant was not entitled to an award of attorney's fees for either the party's trial or the party's previous appeal. The district court's order on these issues was specific, articulate, well thought out, and supported by both the facts and law applicable to this case. If I may, I'd like to turn to the question posed by Judge Ross earlier, the standard of review. I believe it is an abuse of discretion, Your Honor. And the reason I point to that is the opinion out of this court at page 8 noted, we review a district court's application of the principle of comity for an abuse of discretion, and that site is In Re Civ, civil commitment of hand. Wanted to turn to that. I also like to address very briefly the notion, because I think the hinging of the file ultimately comes down to this.
Was there a different standard of review on the question of whether public policy is violated by the enforcement, abuse of discretion on the question of comity, but then you get to the question of the same issue, the same legal question apparently of unconscionability embedded within the enforceability of an antenuptial agreement. And that concern is in the common law without regard to whether we're talking about comity. I'm not sure that is a question that's reviewed for an abuse of discretion. I saw something, at least in one case, that suggested that was a question of law. So I was confused about that.
Sure.
What's your research tell you?
I would say, Your Honor, that a misapplication of the law is by definition an abuse of discretion by the district court. So if the district court misapplies the law as found by this court, that would constitute an abuse of discretion. I don't think that's inconsistent with the standard of review, though, Your Honor. I would also note, Your Honor,
but we don't need to defer to the district court's interpretation of the law. I mean, isn't this the kind of an example of what some people refer to as a nested standard of review, where the general standard of review includes, if it's an abuse of discretion, it includes misapplications of the law, but when we decide whether the district court misapplied the law, we're essentially engaging in a de novo analysis of that question. Like I'm not aware of any authority with that would require us to afford some deference to the district court's discretion to misapply the law. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, Your Honor. I agree. Absolutely no deference is provided to a district court's determination of the law, Your Honor. So,
as to the district court's application of the law, when it comes to unconscionability, the district court found, after remand, the conclusion that enforcement of the antenuptial agreement is not unconscionable arises from the following facts established by preponderance. And then you have finding 24A, husband had a choice whether to accept it. You have finding B, wife was not pregnant when the parties married. Finding C, when executed, when the parties executed the agreement, yada, yada. Then the next finding, when the parties executed it, and so forth. And the next finding, when the parties executed, and the next finding, when the parties executed, and then the finding before the parties executed, and so forth. It does seem to be rather thin on the question of unconscionability at the time of the enforcement,
yeah,
as opposed to the time of the creation.
I would challenge the premise that their counsel is asking the court, appellant is asking the court to adopt that we must apply antenuptial provisions relative to this particular agreement. First of all, the problem with that, Your Honor, is this is not an apples-to-apples case, and that is why we have the doctrine of comity, because judgments in one jurisdiction, even though they may sometimes look and be referred to by statutes we're familiar to, are not the same. In this particular situation, what we're talking about is a dissolution of and liquidation of the marital estate. That is the actual agreement the parties entered into. They entered into that agreement because in that jurisdiction, the marital estate is considered to be a corpus, and the liquidation of that corpus at the time of marriage means that there's nothing to put back into that body. That's their legal theory. We don't have a corollary legal theory with an antenuptial agreement. We do have a corollary legal theory within legal separation. A legal separation in this state, Your Honor, is where the parties actually remain married, they separate their property, and they move forward as married individuals, but without the ability to commingle property. So it is a misguided argument and application that appellant asked the court to adopt to somehow just simply say, well, this is a, literally the argument is this. It's a postnuptial agreement because it happened after the marriage, and because we have postnuptial agreements and our law applies postnuptial standards by our antenuptial standards, ergo, we should apply substantive fairness test to the question of unconscionability. That is not a linear argument, Your Honor. That is not a linear argument.
Do you agree that if we were to disagree with the district court's apparent application of an analysis at the time of execution versus enforcement, that your client would have a more difficult time of persuading us that it was not unconscionable at the time of enforcement?
I'd like, if I could respond with three quick points. One, the standard for unconscionability is remarkably high. As the case law sets forth, which we look to national law when it comes to comity, given the fact that that's where this law doctrine derives from, it has to be repugnant to morality, not just differences of public policy. And I would quote, Your Honor, so offensive to our public policy as to be prejudicial to recognize standards of morality in the general interest of the citizens. It is rarely, infrequently met, and the standard is very high. This is not a substantive fairness standard test under McKee v. Johnson or Kramer v. Kramer discourse. This is a doctrine that has set forth the bar very high, because the premise is we do not want to disinclined to recognize judgments from other jurisdictions, given the fact that at some point our judgments are going to be enforced in other jurisdictions as well. So, A, the standard is extraordinarily high. B, it is a misstatement to say a marital estate, quote unquote, of 1.2 million, 1 point whatever million it is. The marital estate was never determined in this case. It was determined there is no marital estate to value. So it's not an oversight by the district court. The district court is certainly not afraid to acknowledge what values are. The district courts have been quite plain spoken in this case, whether it's Judge Burns or Judge Thomas. They have no shyness about them. There is no value that an appellant can point to say this is what my client lost, because there was no value created. What appellant asked the court to accept is the idea of what appellant wants to value it as, and says, if we value the estate, this would it be. It would be $1.2 million. There's no shred of documentary evidence finding anywhere in the district court record to support that number. Three, appellant wants to define value solely by dollars. That's the crux of the argument. The crux of the argument, there's $1.2 million out here. He should have got half of that, $600,000. He's been unconscionable. It's unfair. If we did this in Minnesota, it would never happen. This individual received benefits well beyond the value of whatever the marital estate would have been valued at had we done that. A, he avoided his creditors. He's clearly done that. That was clearly what he set out to do. He clearly intended to defraud his creditors, and he effectively did so. Two, he benefited from a very high standard of living that he did not have to support. He did not have to fund that standard of living. He did not have to pay for the things, the house they lived in, the trips they took, the vacations they had, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Three, he also benefited from the value that respondent provided to him during the course of the marriage in the form of career coaching, counseling, trainings, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, to try to help him improve himself. So if we want to start looking at what did appellant receive in the context of this negotiation, which he negotiated, he got exactly what he negotiated for. He received 10 years of value of avoiding his creditors, living a lifestyle he didn't create, and
it sounds like you're asking us to conduct an evaluation on circumstances that the district court did not expressly incorporate into its unconscionability determination. Am I correct?
I think I'm asking the court to simply acknowledge the record, which includes the information I provided. This is what I have just argued, Your Honor, is undisputed facts. This is in the court record. Whether or not Judge Thomas cited to it in the unconscionability findings or not. But I would also identify, Your Honor, Judge Thomas did touch on these things. I think Judge Thomas did touch on these things, and she touched on them when you have the PowerPoint that appellant created or helped create that he emails to the immigration attorney solely for the purpose of recognizing these agreements for his own personal benefit. And that benefit was going forward, Your Honor. You identified that. It's going forward. He wants not only the present value of avoiding his creditors, he wants the knowledge that in the future his creditors are not going to be able to come after their marital assets. They are going to keep them separate. They intend to keep them separate, and he is going to benefit.
Can I put you in a different lane?
Certainly, Your Honor.
Before your time escapes you completely. Minnesota Statute, Section 518.14.
Yes, Your Honor.
If the district court finds that a party in a family court matter doesn't have the means to pay attorney's fees, the other party does have the means to pay attorney's fees, and that there's a good faith and that the attorney's fees are generated in order to pursue a good faith legal position, does the district court have discretion not to award attorney's fees?
I think the district court has the there's two fee awards, Your Honor, and I think they both have a somewhat different analysis in this case. One is the fee award that was remanded relative to the party's trial, and the second one is the fee award or remand relative to the order related to the appeal.
Correct, but as a general legal proposition, does the district court have discretion not to award attorney's fees under the statute if the party seeking attorney's fees doesn't have the means, the party against whom the attorney fee request is being made does have the means, and the party seeking the fees has asserted a good faith, colorable claim, non-frivolous claim that the district court has to decide. Does the district court have discretion to say, no, you don't get attorney's fees under the statute?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the reason is there language in the statute that supports that?
There would be, Your Honor. One is the finding still has to be the definition of good faith. Two, appellant still has the burden.
My question presumed a good faith. If there was a good faith, assuming good faith, assuming no means by one, means for the other, is there language in the statute that affords the district court discretion whether to award attorney's fees?
Yes, Your Honor, because appellant still has to present a specific amount and notation of the fees being claimed pursuant to Rule 119. Any fee claim over $1,000, which is in this case, has to meet Rule 119 requirements, Your Honor. That requirement requires the party seeking fees to specifically detail.
This is what I'm concerned about.
Yep.
The district court says, on both, you mentioned there's two. There's sort of the fees that this court pointed out the district court hadn't addressed after having already found that one had the means and the other didn't. This court said there, you know, that the district court said there wasn't a good faith assertion of a claim because, and the district court's focus was only on the question of the antenuptial agreement. And this court said there's other things. There's custody. Right. There's also spousal maintenance that was debated that the district court says was at least possible despite the antenuptial agreement. There's also child support, which this court didn't mention. But those things were all decided by the district court. There are multiple findings on all of those issues. And the district court said that essentially all of that stuff is marginal.
Correct.
When I look at I'm wondering whether it's an abuse of discretion after just looking at the first, the there's two, as you mentioned, the first category of potential attorney's fees. After this court expressly remanded to the district court to decide the question of attorney's fees based on the district court's prior finding of, sure, of no means and means, and this court's assertion that there was a good faith claim, why doesn't the district court at least have to say, okay, I don't have enough, there's not a lot of detail, but I've got to estimate somehow that there's something.
I would say two things. One, I'm not certain that Judge Burns conceded that appellant did not have the ability to pay in the original order, Your Honor. What I mean by that is Judge Burns focused on the good faith, but the problem we have is appellant is voluntarily underemployed. He has been found to be voluntarily underemployed.
That was the other problem I had with the second part. What is the basis? Is there any authority for the district court to essentially impute means based upon, I mean, for attorney fees?
Sure.
Not for spousal maintenance, not for child support.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there case law to support this district court's approach to means?
Well, there's the facts. And what I mean, there's the expert opinion that imputed, I think, roughly almost $9,000 per month. And there was appellant's own budget that he provided, if I may answer the question, Your Honor, to the district court at the time of trial of a budget of $5,000. Those are his needs, $5,000. So if he has the ability to generate income above and beyond $5,000, it's logical for the district court then to say, you have the ability to meet some of your legal fees. And that's just in the record, Your Honor, that his budget is $5,000 and he was found to be able to generate at least $8,000 to $9,000.
Pursue a further question on this. You know, I understand that. And if this were about spousal maintenance, we've got plenty of case law that says, well, you can impute income. You know, this is how much you could be making. You're voluntarily underemployed or unemployed. But in this case, the question is means to pay an attorney fee. Do you have, is there case law to support what the district court did as it regards need-based attorney's fees?
I think, no, there's no case law I'm going to point to that would specifically answer that. There is abundant case law as to the broad discretion of the district court to determine attorney's fees generally. But I would say again, factually, Your Honor, if the individual is found to be able to generate roughly almost $9,000 in income per month at a minimum, and his purported budget is $5,000, there is an excess, by definition, to contribute to something else.
And if you impute income to him, yes.
But he was, Your Honor. He was found to be voluntarily underemployed.
No, I understand that. But I'm just, in this context,
right,
I'm not sure I know of a case where this process of imputing income extends to means, not... Usually when we talk about imputing income, the idea is going forward, how much can you make? The question for attorney's fees is how much do you have right now? And it looks like, at least one might argue, that the district court sort of punishes him for his voluntary unemployment as to attorney's fees, and I'm not sure the case law supports that. Even if it feels morally right. I'm not sure the case law supports it.
I have no moral opinion one way or the other. I would say logically it's correct because you have a finding in one part of your decision that you can generate X amount of dollars, and then you have a finding in another part of your decision that says, well, we're just going to take you at zero because you're not making zero. But if I could just very briefly answer, I know I'm well past my time.
Well, that's because of me. I put you past your
Well, I'm the counsel, though, Your Honor. You get to do that. I don't know if I have the same latitude. The district court pointed out two very specific things. One, temporary maintenance was ordered throughout the course of these proceedings, $2,500, plus all of his expenses paid while he lived there. And Judge Byrne specifically said the intent of this is to help you get employed, help you spend this time during the proceedings, 2 years. Find a job. Do this so you don't have to continue to receive that. Never happened, Your Honor. Not once. If that's not bad faith, I don't know what would be, Your Honor. I'm sure I'm out of time.
But I have another question for you on this same point. The first order that came up on appeal before us, the district court was very clear that the second and third factors are met, that father does not have the ability to pay and mother does have the ability to pay. So why is the district court going beyond that in the amended findings to say now father did have the ability to pay?
Well, I would argue a father always had the ability to pay based on the findings the court made relative to spousal maintenance.
Sure, but that's not what the finding on the first order or what our court said in the first appeal.
I would say two things, Your Honor. One is that Judge Thomas actually viewed appellant's decision not to be employed in any way as bad faith. And this was remanded on whether or not he was a good faith litigant or not. Was he putting forward good faith litigation? That's what Judge Thomas said. I am telling the court with the record, as I can see the skepticism from Judge Ross.
Yes, good faith on one element, not on whether he had the means to pay. That was determined by the district court before it got to us. That was something this court based its decision on.
If I can just still point back to one thing. Appellant has to document how much money is related to good faith claims. It is not Judge Thomas's burden. And if anybody should have known after remand that they need to figure out how to trace their money, it was appellant. Judge Thomas doesn't have a crystal ball. She can't get $56,000 or $112,000 worth of invoices and say, I think it's this much. She actually said the vast majority of this litigation was revolving around contracts that were found unenforceable. So, again, I think the court is trying to fault the judge, my words, not yours, when in fact appellant certainly had the obligation to create a clear paper trail for Judge Thomas to follow. He did not. Unless there's other questions, Your Honor.
All right,
thank you very much.
A myriad questions and no more time.
Thank goodness.
First of all, there's an extraordinary amount of detail in the affidavit of fees that we filed.
In the first district court order that came up on appeal, you were asking for $111,542 in fees. On the second time around, you're asking for $99,472.
And the reason for that is simple. We exclude all of the fees surrounding the litigation in 2021 regarding the enforceability of those Colombian documents, we scrapped that. That's excluded. The $99,000 has to do with the trial and fees that were not related to our challenge to the, because that, you know, that's essentially what the law was, and that's what the...
Well, the district court seemed to be in disagreement about that the district court couldn't discern the one versus the other, and the district court said, essentially, all that other stuff, other than the antenuptial agreement, was marginal in the litigation.
Let me just point this out. We had a 3-day trial on two issues, spousal maintenance and the legal custody issue. This is the transcript. It's 500 and some pages long. About half of the testimony relates to joint legal custody. So I think... This is a case where the district court is just wrong. We excluded all the fees that related to enforcement of the contract that were incurred in 2021. We included fees for preparation of trial and for that trial on two issues that were in good faith,
and we should have received attorney's fees for that. The district court was saying things like, well, if you have a conference with a client, I don't know what you're talking about. Are you talking about the Colombian documents? Are you talking about custody? What? So she was requiring like a minute-by-minute breakdown of...
Well, there is some merit to a concern if there's a lot of client conversation. How much of it does go to one or the other? Was there an attempt to quantify or to estimate or to do something or representation?
I think if you review the schedule that's attached to the affidavit, which, by the way, is precisely the same as the invoices. You know, the district court judge says, well, you didn't attach invoices. Those are the invoices in schedule form. It's easy to see that it related to a three-day trial regarding legal custody and regarding spousal maintenance. Spousal maintenance, you can't say that was in bad faith. The first district court judge said, well, yeah, I'm enforcing this Colombian document, but appellant still has a spousal maintenance claim. So we try a spousal maintenance claim. You can't go back and say, well, gee, that's in bad faith, too. So it was approximately $100,000 of fees.
Was there any litigation over, I know there was findings as to child support. Was it contested or was it just simply given to the court?
One point I have to make before I forget. There are no findings by Judge Burns about appellant's earning capacity at all. There's just a finding that he should have gotten a job. He's had 2 years. He should have gotten a job. There's no finding about his earning capacity. He does include $100,000 in the child support grid, but he doesn't...
You're not disputing, are you, that he was the finding that he was voluntarily unemployed?
Well, I think we're past that. Actually, if you ask me that question candidly, yes. We don't believe he was voluntarily unemployed, but we're past that because the spousal maintenance issue has been resolved by this court. But what? But I got to say, if you read, it's page 17 of this court's opinion, where it says, we conclude that it's appropriate to remand this issue to the district court to determine whether enforcement of the DLMP would be unconscionable. And then in the footnote, there is an extensive discussion of McKee-Johnson. That is the test. The McKee-Johnson court test is whether unanticipated changed circumstances during the marriage have upended the reasonable expectations of the parties when they signed the agreement. And the McKee-Johnson court noted that the birth of a child might be one such changed circumstance.
Might be, but why in this case would it be? After the birth of the child, your client went out and got a $130,000 job after 6 months of...
He got a temporary position, and he wasn't asked back, so... Yes, I understand that, but
and then chose not to apply. I mean, so what I'm just trying to get a sense, since you're asking us to say the district court essentially abused its discretion in analyzing that issue. I think that's what it comes down to. And if for us to say the district court got it wrong, we have to say, look at the record, look at all the stuff the district court overlooked that would show this is not what the parties contemplated. That this is. He's got these huge. He's got a huge hardship now as a result.
Well, first of all, the district court applied the wrong standard of unconscionability, the standard that's applied to commercial contracts, not the standard that's applied to postnuptial agreements. There's this language.
Right. Let's assume we're correct on that. My question, though, is if we're going to say that let's assume we agree that that's error. If we're going to say it's any more than harmless error, we'd have to look at the record and say, if the district court had applied the right standard, look at all the evidence of unconscionability.
I think I've said that. Moving from state to state in furtherance of her career, she earns $1.9 million. He earns nothing. He has a part-time job, earning some money for a period of 9 months. There's the birth of twins. He at least participated. He would say he did more than half the caretaking, but the evidence is at least half of the caretaking. All of that occurred after the move to the United States. I think the evidence is there. But we don't know how the district court viewed all of that because there are no findings about that at all. The focus was when it was signed, and the focus was on this commercial contract standard that you heard counsel say, well, has to be repugnant to the morals, or it has to be the kind of agreement no one in their right mind would sign. That's not the standard. It's McKee-Johnson.
And it's both, isn't it? At the time it was signed and at the end, at the time of enforcement?
Pardon?
Isn't it both? Don't you look at
yes,
it both?
Yes, but we conceded that at the time it was signed. I mean, it doesn't really say anything. It's like they're saying that the rights would be as if no marriage occurred. And there are, by the way, there are prenuptial agreements that say that as well in Minnesota, okay?
So if we rule in your favor, we would remand for the district court to address at the time of enforcement.
Yes.
Okay.
I believe that would, I mean, actually in the brief, we were saying there's enough here to invalidate the agreement totally, but I think that would be the logical next step, that it would be a remand to focus on
when you say in the brief, you mean in the brief in the previous appeal, not this one?
Actually, and then this brief, we were arguing that.
Well, our court's already decided the question of the validity based upon the authority of the notary, and this is a judgment, not
right.
just a contract.
Right. No, it's the only focus is the substantive fairness at the time of proposed enforcement. That's the only issue. And, you know, again, we fought hard and lost on the procedural fairness. I mean, this was an agreement in Spanish that was given to him. He's not fluent in Spanish, given to him the day before. The postnuptial agreement was supposed to be signed after they got married. It was pre-signed before they got married. There were a lot of procedural irregularities. That's all water over the dam. But the idea at this point that she has a high six-figure income. She has $1.2 million in assets, which have probably grown since the valuation date. He has nothing. He's living with his parents, and there's a huge, enormous disparity.
He doesn't have nothing. He has the earning capacity that he's demonstrated.
Well,
which is
so
not,
far that earning capacity has not borne any fruit for him.
Not if he's voluntarily unemployed, which is a finding we're stuck with.
Yeah. Well, it's a finding I'm stuck with, but look at the evidence. Look at Mark Radersdorf's testimony. He said, yes, he could have a significant barrier now to entrance into the job market. His speech impediment and the fact that he's from Poland, so Polish is his first language. He can't put sentences together very well in English. That might have a bearing.
But you're not suggesting that we should reevaluate or revisit the finding of fact that your client is voluntarily unemployed, and that wasn't just in the previous proceeding. That continues on, according to the district court, after remand. We're not revisiting that. You're not asking us to, are you?
No.
Okay.
No. But it is evidence in the record. Counsel was saying about all the evidence in the record. Well, the evidence in the record is not as clear cut as he would say. I don't think this is a party that has the ability to go out and get a good job. He certainly hasn't so far.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank
your time
thank
has
you.
Expired. With that, the case is submitted. Thank you both, counsel,
for your arguments today.
And with that, we are adjourned for today.
All rise.
Good. Rest your day.